tell us so. This morning we return again to settling the mind in its natural state. And we'll go for this very encompassing, three-dimensional, kind of holistic vision of space of the mind, attending to that, at the same time aware of the events coming and going. So there is simultaneously the stillness of the space of the mind, and then the movements, thoughts, images, and so on. So a simultaneity of that stillness and the motion, right? At the same time, there's another simultaneity, and that is the stillness of our own awareness and the activity, the movements of the space of the mind. So it's a brief preamble, and then kind of front-loading the meditation so I can speak very little during the meditation, so you can be more single-pointed. I'd like to give you kind of a sneak preview of how does this evolve over time. My source here is the Sharp Vajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra, the most quintessential of all of Dujom Nyingma's mind treasures on the Great Perfection, where he addresses this, and then a brilliant commentary it's his own commentary written down by a disciple of his named Pema Dashi. But he, as I've commented before, and so now a very brief reminder, the kind of the entrance, the avenue to get into the practice, so you know it's starting to click, is first of all, the ability to distinguish experientially between stillness and motion. So we've covered that, right? But now there are now four sequential modes or dimensions of mindfulness that manifest as one evolves along this path of shamatha. I think I've mentioned the first one, and it's single-pointed mindfulness. Single-pointed mindfulness. And then this, once you're able to distinguish between the stillness of the mind, stillness of the space of the mind, movement of thoughts, stillness of awareness, movements of thoughts, and other mental events, once you're able to make that distinction, then the first mode of mindfulness is to be able to be aware of the motion and the stillness simultaneously. Right? So that's that. So how does that occur? By releasing all grasping. So it is something subtle to be able to attend very closely, very attentively, without grasping. Normally, when we are not grasping, then we're bored, we're listless, kind of like whatever, you know, in one ear, out the other ear. No grasping, but no real attention. And normally, when we're really interested in something, we're doing so with desire, with aversion, with craving, clinging, identification. That's what really catches our attention when it has to do with I, me, mine. And so a lot of grasping coming out. And here, we're once again looking for that middle way, to attend very closely to something and free of the grasping, right? Well, that's it. Insofar as your awareness is free of grasping, then even as you are aware of comings and goings of the mind, you're not moved from your throne. That is, the awareness does not move from its own place, become fused with the objects, grasping onto, identifying with them, but is totally and discerningly present with whatever arises in the space of the mind. Right? So that's the first mode of mindfulness. Once you click with that, now you're on the path. Now you're on the shamatha path, okay? A little mini path. The termination, the end of the line, is simply achieving shamatha, right? Then you have to get out of the train and get in another train, right? But the shamatha express, you're in the train and you're in motion. You're really on the path when you've achieved, you've tasted, experienced that first mode of mindfulness. And then it's simply a matter of cultivating it. It's so simple. And the method doesn't change. That's what's something remarkable about this practice. It doesn't go to higher and higher levels. It's exactly the same method that just gets subtler and subtler and subtler, which is to say, more relaxed, more still, more vivid, synergistically, right? So there you are just in this cultivating more and more of a sense of flow, of the simultaneous awareness of stillness and motion. And through that familiarization, then that leads you to the second mode of mindfulness, which is called manifest mindfulness. And that's where, with very little effort, you kind of like, you slip into the slipstream. You just slip into flow. It's a very nice word for modern psychology. It really is flow. A continuity that is relatively effortless. Just that, this ongoing continuum of resting in your own space while aware of the comings and goings, not only of objective appearances, but also subjective impulses, identifying with none of them, totally attentive to, aware of, as much as you can, all of them. So the second mode of mindfulness is manifest mindfulness, suggesting kind of a more effortless flow of that simultaneous awareness of stillness and motion. So that state, when tried to map this onto the 9 stages leading to shamatha, more or less stage 4 or so. Stage 4, you're free of coarse excitation. You really have gotten into flow. It's really quite satisfying. You have that sense that you really cannot be bumped off of your meditative object. So you go into kind of a tailspin, spinning out, you know, your attention captured totally by some wandering thought, sensory impression, and so forth, that there's some real continuity there. So something like stage 4. Well, you simply continue in the practice, again, without modifying or trying to improve the method. It's happening to you rather than you happening to it. It's not so much a matter of doing, but just being continually present in that flow, simultaneously aware of stillness and motion, until eventually, as you move along stages 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, way up there, then the third mode of mindfulness clicks in. This is a real showstopper. The third mode of mindfulness is called absence of mindfulness. And one might think, well, but wait a minute, I've already achieved that. I know what that's like. No, not so fast. Not so fast. You're way up there in stage 9. You're driving off the cliff right into shamatha land. And when that happens, your senses will have imploded, so you now are oblivious of your sensory environment, sounds, sights, let alone smell and taste. And also, you really have a sense of having become disembodied, as if you were deep asleep and loose. Here, like this, as if you were in dreamless, lucid, dreamless sleep. Lucid, dreamless sleep. There you are, wide awake, totally asleep, and you have no sense of your body lying horizontally in bed, because you're sensorily completely disengaged from it. Very much like that. Very much like that. So this third mode of mindfulness is called the absence of mindfulness. Your senses have imploded, and the mind, that is that space of the mind in which all these activities were taking place, well, over the course of stages 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, they're just gradually subsiding, you know. The metaphors from a cascading waterfall to a babbling lot of whitewater mountain brook, to a river flowing through a valley, to an ocean unmoved by waves, to a stillness like a vast mountain, Mount Meru. So what's happened here with the implosion of the physical senses and the total calming of the movements of the mind, and that single-pointed focus on the space of the mind and its contents, well, what's happened here is you were focusing on the space of the mind and its contents, and now there aren't any more contents. Those contents were produced by, or arising in association with, or derivative of your coarse mind, your ordinary mind, your psyche, woman's psyche, man's psyche, and so forth, right? But now that's calmed. Your coarse mind, your familiar mind, the one that we identify with so strongly, with our personal history and all of that, it's dissolved. It's like an ice cube that just now melted completely into water. And so the mental faculty of mindfulness that was embedded in the network of your coarse mind vanishes. The ship sank, so all on board sank. The ship of your coarse mind sank, so all of the mental factors that are concomitant with or part of your coarse mind, they all go down with the ship. Your coarse mind is dissolved. You've lost it. Now, you get it back. Don't worry, if you value that. But since the mindfulness, the coarse mindfulness, was part of the coarse mind, and the coarse mind is now has dissolved, it's imploded, and you are focused single-pointedly on the space of the mind and its contents, now there are no more contents. All that's left is your awareness of that sheer vacuity. And as you recall, the word mindfulness in all of the Asian Buddhist languages, from Pali right on through Mongolian and Japanese and Chinese, it has a connotation of recollection. Remember? Recollection. It's absolutely core. Wildly forgotten in the kind of the modern Vipassana movement. They throw that out, baby bathwater and everything, but they've missed something, like it primarily means recollection. Well, in this mode now, you've lost your mind, so not your, in that context, you're no longer recollecting anything. You've just slipped into this awareness of this vacuity with no recollection, which means an absence of mindfulness, but you're still bright. You're still clear. There's still a flow of cognizance, but it's not a recollective cognizance. It's just a sheer cognizance. So bear in mind, you've not just gone blotto, uncognizant. You've not passed out at all. No, that continuity of cognizance is all the way through here. But now you're cognizant of almost nothing. And you're recollecting nothing. Mindfulness of the Course mind has vanished. Therefore, it's called absence of mindfulness. Okay? So that's the third. Happily, there's a fourth one. And that's called luminous mindfulness. Luminous mindfulness. Naturally luminous mindfulness. That's what it's called. Or self-illuminating mindfulness. Even better. Rangshar, it's called in Tibetan. Rangnang. Rangnang. Self-illuminating. Self-illuminating mindfulness. And what happens here as you're focusing, bear in mind, you've gotten very, very single-pointed here. So single-pointed that everything else just kind of fades out. The sensory, your body, everything else, thoughts have dissolved away. Like the snow globe, with all the snow shaken up, well, all the snow's come down, it's now just transparent. And so now you're single-pointedly focused there on the space of the mind. And it's just your sheer three-dimensional vacuity, right? And that's the absence of mindfulness. But now you perform a certain kind of maneuver, like a wrestling maneuver, and you invert your awareness right in upon itself. Instead of just resting there, single-pointedly aware of that vacuity, resting there, now you invert. Turn it right back in upon itself. Self-reflexive. Right? And then what do you discover? Sheer luminosity. Not a sheer vacuity. The sheer unmediated, unveiled luminosity of consciousness stripped bare down to the bare essentials. And now you are clearly recognizing experientially what are the salient characteristics, what are the defining characteristics of consciousness. Stripped down, naked. It's not human, it's not female, not Anglo, it's not nothing. It's got no ethnicity to it all, it has no personal history to it all. It's just bare-bones consciousness, stripped down, naked. And what's left over is sheer luminosity and sheer cognizance. And that's natural luminosity. That's not something you generated. That's something you unveiled. So welcome home. If you didn't know better, you might very easily think, and many people have thought, according to the great meditation masters of Tibet, if you've gotten there and you don't know better, if you've not received further teachings along the path, you may very well think, this is it. This is nirvana. It doesn't get any better than this. You know? It's peaceful, it's luminous, it's cognizance, it's removed from all the world of troubles, all the stuff out there, all the junk of samsara, removed from all of that. You can hang out there effortlessly. It's blissful, it's serene, it's luminous. You say, hey, this got to be Buddha nature. Buddha nature couldn't be better than this. Well, that's just because you don't know any better. This is just the ground of the ordinary mind. This is not the ground of ultimate ground of reality. This is the ground of your own personal continuum of samsara. Before it gets configured as this or that, human, non-human, male, female, and all the rest, before it gets configured, this is your basic inheritance. It's waiting for you at the end of the line when you reach the dead zone. But the problem is those of us who don't achieve shamatha in this lifetime, those who haven't or won't or don't, then the chances are we'll pass through the dying process non-lucidly. We'll get to the payload. We'll get to the, you know, down to the ground, and it's just blackout. It's just comatose. Big disappointment. It's kind of like, welcome to your inheritance. You sleep right through it, you know. And then you're off into the clear light of death. What? And then that's over. And you enter the bardo. And if you're not lucid, that's more what? And then out of the cannon of your karma, you're propelled into your next lifetime. And then it's what? And you get one more lifetime. It really sucks. That's samsara. So you've really got two choices. You can either do all of this lucidly, or you can do it non-lucidly. There's the easy way and the hard way. Good cop, bad cop. So that's the whole trajectory. And once you get out there, your major challenge, once you've achieved shamatha and you've achieved this naturally luminous or self-illuminating mindfulness, which is just dwelling in the substrate consciousness, but of course you're not really withdrawn from the substrate. So now it's really a non-duality, your experience of the substrate consciousness and the substrate, the space of the mind. Those two are totally coextensive. So you're just resting there in this beautiful, serene, luminous, blissful space. And your major challenge, and it is an enormous challenge at this time, is not to get stuck there. Because you're going to be one satisfied, happy camper when you get there. You're going to say, whoa, I never imagined it could be this good. And I don't need any better than this, because this is just fine as is. So all that stuff about other stuff, what was that other stuff? Vipassana, Dzogchen, Bodhicitta? Yeah, whatever. Yeah, whatever. But, you know, I'm happy, so, you know, chill. I'm going to hang out here. And if that's what you do, then Dujom Lingpa says, you have not moved one hair's breadth towards enlightenment. You are nowhere. You're sitting in the middle of the Pacific Ocean treading water. You might enjoy the water, but how long can you tread water? You know? And then eventually the energy from that will fade out. This lifetime, next lifetime, it'll fizzle out, and then you're right back where you started. Because nothing really, there was no irreversible shift. There was no real path. A path means something that is a shift of irreversible evolution. That's what path is. And Dujon Lingpa, I would have to say, I don't think I'm reading this into him, he's absolutely passionate about path. About path, of going deep enough by way of shamatha. But shamatha is just the entryway, the access to entering the path. And the real path begins with vipassana, with insight. With insight that brings about irreversible transformation, liberation, and then moves you along a path that is irreversible, true evolution. And that really all of his five mind treasures are all focusing on that one theme. It's marga in Sanskrit, it's path. Shamatha is necessary, indispensable, and not sufficient. So that's that. So, that was front loading the session. Now, let's go into the session. I can speak very little now. Let's just do it. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states, and for a little while, calm the obsessive, discursive mind with mindfulness of breathing. Then with your eyes at least partially open, your gaze vacant, resting in the space in front of you, direct your attention single-pointedly to the space of the mind and its contents, focusing first of all on the players that appear on the stage of your mind, the thoughts, the images, the memories, but also the subjective impulses of desires, emotions, and so on. All the while, letting your awareness remain still in its own place, illuminating the stage of the mind. Now and then check up on the body. See that it's utterly at ease. All the muscles of the face soft and relaxed. The eyes soft, unfocused. And the breath flowing unimpededly. Now direct your attention primarily to the background, not the foreground, to the stage of the mind, the space of the mind which is most evident during the intervals between thoughts. You don't need to probe into it, investigate it, analyze it. Simply attend closely with a non-discursive, non-conceptual mind, sustaining the flow of cognizance, and over time, allow it to reveal itself so that you ascertain it more and more clearly. As you attend closely to the space of the mind, you can directly observe thoughts, images, emotions, desires emerging from this space, not emerging from some external object outside in physical space, not emerging from the brain, but emerging right here phenomenologically from the space of your own mind. Sustain now this flow of mindfulness in which you are simultaneously aware of the space of the mind from which all thoughts and other events emerge, in which they are present, and into which they dissolve. Sustain the mindfulness simultaneously of this space and the movements within the space, together with the stillness of your own awareness. In other words, sustain the flow of single-pointed mindfulness. And let's continue practicing now in silence. Hola, so. A couple of questions here lingering over from earlier talk, coming back to karma but more explicitly. What is the job description of the Buddhas? What do they actually do? So the first one was, and these are two related ones. I haven't gotten to this one just arrived. So probably have time just for these two, but they are closely related. So follow up from the discussion last night regarding this question, Jim's question pertaining to Buddhas and karma. The question here from Morgan is, if the Buddhas exist as an aspect of our own pristine awareness, which they don't, not as an aspect, the hair is an aspect of my head, teeth an aspect of my mouth, Buddhas are not an aspect of awareness. So it's not like that. All the displays of Buddhas, like Buddha Shakyamuni or Maitreya or Manjushri and so forth, they're effulgences, creative displays of awareness, but I wouldn't quite say, words are very important, wouldn't quite say they are aspects. But if this is the case, then why is there an emphasis in all the schools of Tibetan Buddhism, not only Tibetan, Indian Buddhism, Mongolian, Chinese Buddhism, and so on, all schools of Buddhism in making offerings to the Buddhas, and specifically in the preliminary practices of 100,000 mandala offerings as a prerequisite for Dzogchen practice? Well, actually, it's a preliminary practice for all kinds of Vajrayana practice, not just Dzogchen. If the purpose is to cultivate generosity and diminish grasping, then why not make offerings to sentient beings who actually could, you didn't say it, but who actually would get some benefit from it? You know, if people are hungry and you give them some food, then same thing, remember. There's an action and then somebody actually receives it and they say, thank you, this is really helpful. But if you think of the Buddhas, for example, as being in some pure land, like Amitabha's pure land, and you just offer them some food, maybe some fruit and some nuts and some candy. I mean, there they are sitting. Do you think there's, oh, good, I was kind of getting bored of Pure Land food. Now we got some junk food from California. Just what I was hoping for. Thanks so much. Send a truck up, you know. It is a bit funny, isn't it? Or let alone, yes, we've had a real drought in the Pure Land. Thank you so much for your 7 bowls of offering water. We really needed that. Give us a straw. So what's the point then? And I'm speaking a bit with irony here. Well, Dzogchen Lingpa does the same thing. He does the same thing. If you're going to reify the Buddhas and think they somehow get a kick out of your offerings, and they actually, you know, and then you see, do you ever see them diminishing? Like, oh yeah, the Buddhas are sipping it up. I saw 3 of my Mars bars disappeared over, like the reverse of Santa Claus, you know. The Buddhas just come in and eat your munchies. So we should be ridiculing this. We're not ridiculing the Buddhas. Dzogchen Lingpa, you know, he's a Vidyadhara, for heaven's sake. Last thing he's going to do is ridicule Buddhas, but he doesn't mind ridiculing the reification of Buddhas. So what is this about? And that is, let's take Tara. Imagine Tara. Here is a personification, an enlightened embodiment of the pure compassion, the dynamic compassion of all the Buddha's minds. And then symbolically there, you know, whether the green form, this more dynamic aspect, the more sheer pure form of life, of the white Tara. And what is this? It's, of course, it's a symbol. Does she live someplace in the east, north, south, and something like that? Is she far away, near, how far away? Another galaxy or maybe another planet? You know, all such questions make no sense whatsoever. But if we consider this is the personification of that facet of my pristine awareness. But now let's just pause right there. When we say my pristine awareness, I try to use words very carefully. And this is correct usage. Rangi Rigpa, my, one's own, my pristine awareness. But it's so easy when we think that, to think like, well, like my country, you know, it's not Europe, it's not Mexico or Canada, you know, the one in between. My country is something local, my planet, my galaxy, okay, not the other galaxies. And so whenever we say my, it does tend to have a sense of locality to it, and a position in space and time. Well, that's absolutely not the meaning of one's own pristine awareness, one's own primordial consciousness. But they do use this term, one's own. So this is why it's taught. You don't just read it and figure you're going to understand it just by reading the words. And my strong sense here is that it says your own, so you completely banish the thought that it's somebody else's. That it's somebody else's. And that is when you are envisioning or imagining, visualizing Tara in front of you. and you bring forth her memories. Of course, it's not just a light display. It's not just a visualization. If it is, then it's just a piece of art. But you don't make any offerings to art. You're bringing to mind the visualization in a way like bringing to mind the image of your mother. Well, you don't love the image. The image won't love you back. It's just an image, right? But by way of the image of your mother, whether she's living or dead, if you have a close and fond relationship with your mother, then by bringing the image to mind, then this arouses the love, the affection, the gratitude, and all that may come with that in a loving parent-child relationship. And it's by way of the image. And that image, as you recall her qualities, her love, her attentiveness, the kindness she's shown you, then this really stirs the heart. And that's just relationship parent-child, right? But in a similar fashion, you bring to mind the image of Tara, the mother of all the Buddhas, it said. And then what does this symbolize? What does this represent? Well, it represents a fathomless compassion, like that of a mother for her only child, for all sentient beings, including yourself. And so in envisioning this, now I get to your question, revering it, honoring it, and say, this is the pinnacle. This is something to take refuge in. This is of ultimate value. Here is an object, a personification worthy of the deepest, fathomless reverence in all that I have to offer. My food, my pantry, my house, my car, my body, my mind, all my virtues of the three times, accumulated in the past, present, and whatever virtues I may ever accumulate in the future, all of this as a display of my reverence, my total commitment, my devotion, my aspiration to realize you, this I offer. So I'm going to jump tracks here. So, of course, it sounds somewhat theistic. And as I mentioned before, somewhat theistic and then not. Because this is not theism as I've described before. But slipping over to a theist, St. Augustine, the most influential Christian after St. Paul for all traditions. I learned this when I was a graduate student at Stanford. I found it very, very helpful. In a book called Amor Dei, Love of God, by a very fine Christian scholar, really focusing on Augustine. Because that term, when I was growing up as a Christian, my father being a Christian theologian, I really frankly never got that, the love of God business. Because I'd have to feel ambivalence in this thoroughly traditional theistic context. I couldn't see anything other than ambivalence for a God who showers down blessings and then gives you bone cancer, gives you a really good job, and then you have a head-on collision in your total, that sends tornadoes and earthquakes and tsunamis and droughts. And again, all the animals eating each other. It's awful. And so I'd have to say, well, I'd like to love you, but man, you give us a real mixed bag here. And it just didn't make any sense to me that I should feel total devotion. If he's responsible for all of this, I say, why couldn't you have done a better job? Really? Did it really? Just, again, I want to focus on animals. Couldn't you have made them all herbivores? I mean, what would be the downside of this? Just all eating vegetables. And then just making us also that we have cow's teeth and we're just naturally herbivores. We don't even think about it. Would that have been so hard? You know. So I had something of a gripe. But I certainly really couldn't connect with, gee, God, I love you so much. And then as a graduate student, many, many years later, reading Augustine's take on Amor Dei, the love of God, and it, of course, devout Christians love God. There's no question about it. But the way he unpacked that is the love of God is the passionate yearning to know God. That puts an entirely different spin on it for me. That I can relate to. I totally resonate with that. Yeah, sure. The passionate yearning to know God. That's the Amor Dei, the love of God. So in a similar fashion, the love of Tara, the worship of Tara, the devotion to Tara, offering your body, speech, and mind, and all that is good in your life, offering Mount Meru, offering the universe and all galaxies, all the beauties of the universe, and offering this all up to Tara. It's almost like saying, I'm all in. I'm all in. Everything that I can conceive of as being good and beautiful, this I offer to you. You're the embodiment of the ideal of enlightenment that I passionately yearn to realize for myself. That makes sense to me. And then I hold hands with my Christian brothers and sisters. We don't share the same worldview, but I get you. We're Dharma brothers and sisters. And we should be really relaxed about having different worldviews. Because not any one worldview is the best for everybody. So there we are. And then the second question, as an aspect of pristine awareness, so again, as an effulgence of pristine awareness, how do enlightened beings assist others and we ourselves expect to help others upon enlightenment? I read this yesterday, so I had time to ruminate. To reflect upon it. And here's what I came up with as a strong analogy. And that is, I gave the analogy yesterday, there's Maria Elena back in the back row now. But remember when probing into, kind of doing this ultimate investigation, like a real existential probe, an ontological probe into Maria Elena. Is Maria Elena here? And then, you know, Lizette or Lorena says, yeah, she's right over there. And I say, oh yeah? Show me. And I look over there and I see, I'm seeing face, I'm seeing hair, I'm seeing clothing, I'm seeing skin. Not. Hair is not Maria Elena. Face, no. Shirt, no. Torso, no. Body, nope, that's not a person. Okay, and I'm going to be clairvoyant, looking into her thoughts, emotions, and blah, blah, you know, make believe. Nope. None of that's Maria Elena. Okay, is there a Maria Elena that has all of this stuff? You know, the owner and proprietor of a Maria Elena Incorporated. Nope, nowhere to be found. Wow, nowhere to be found. So if I stop right there, then there's just a not finding. And in terms of feeling any affection, any warmth, any loving kindness for Maria Elena, in the sense of having the sense that she is an agent, that she does things, that she's a subject, it's vanished temporarily. Because I probe too deeply. I probe too deeply. So it's a sheer emptiness of there being an autonomous, inherent existent Maria Elena there. Right? So resting there, you're resting in emptiness. But that's not the whole picture. You have to now use that zoom lens and focus back and say, but now within the context of this life, whether it's a lucid dream or whether it's a non-lucid waking state right now, if we ask, is Maria Elena here? And the answer, once again, there's only one right answer. And it's a true answer. And yes, she's right over there. Stay right there. And then we say, Maria Elena, do you hear me? Yes, you do. Maria Elena, how are you feeling? And she would answer, Maria Elena, can I be of assistance to you? And she'll say yes or no. And so on that level, we have to stay right there and say, this is a very meaningful level of discourse. And to deny it is to fall into nihilism. To say that, well, I couldn't find Maria Elena under ontological probe, therefore she's not there, well, that's just idiotic. Because who is the person that engaged in the ontological probe? Nobody? Who did nothing? So this is the balance. This is the balance. That on the one hand, yes, empty of inherent nature, but then that tells you how she doesn't exist. It doesn't tell you how she does exist. And how she does exist is in the ongoing, unfolding flow of relationships. She's Daniel's mother, she's my friend, she's His Holiness's student, I imagine, and she's Tony Karam's student, and so forth and so on. She arises in myriad ways, you know, as we all do, from moment to moment, arising relationally. Always intertwined with the world around us and in relationship with other sentient beings, the inanimate environment. And that's the Maria Elena that one can love, cherish, care for as a friend, and so on. Right. And that's not to be denied. So in a similar fashion, we can say on this deepest level, all of the Buddhas of the three times, past, present, future, throughout all the 10 directions, they're all nothing other than effulgence and spontaneous displays of your own pristine awareness. But what is this own pristine awareness? Your own pristine awareness is primordial consciousness that saturates, permeates all of space and all of time, and yet transcends space and time and transcends all conceptual frameworks, including that of existence and non-existence. It is the ground of reality. That's your own pristine awareness. Nothing local about it. So there's a nice metaphor in this regard from Anagarika Govinda, who was German. He was a Theravada monk and then shifted over to Tibetan Buddhism, had a very nice metaphor for this. And he said it was a common, many people believe, sometimes maybe crops in the Hindu tradition, but let's not dwell there, but the notion of enlightenment being that the water drop of Maria Elena or me or anybody, when you achieve enlightenment, the water drop dissolves into the sea. So you lose your identity and you kind of become one with a kind of a cosmic consciousness and you're gone. But well, there's this cosmic consciousness, so she'd be happy. You know, you kind of dissolved into something much infinitely greater. He said, well, that's not the view in Buddhism. View in Buddhism, if you want to use the metaphor, is this: the ocean dissolves into the water drop. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. When one goes there, to the theme that Tara, Buddha Shakyamuni himself, historical Buddha living 2,500-600 years ago, that Buddha himself was an effulgence of your own pristine consciousness, is to say that the Buddha was an emanation of Dharmakaya, and that is the Mahayana view. not just a historical individual who lived for 80 years and then passed out and totally evaporated into some cosmic non-conceptual space, but actually an effulgence, a display, an emanation of Dharmakaya, Buddha mind, beginningless, endless, and so forth. But if we try to get our feet on the ground here, that's not the way to do it. It's just any more than you'll really understand Maria Elena, the unique qualities of her, and how, what has she done in the world, and how does the world influence her? You're not going to get there if you linger there in the not finding of Maria Elena under an ontological probe. You have to step back and say, that's not the whole story. It's a very important part of the story. It's not the whole story. And so if we ask this question, I guess the other one, which is related from Suzanne, I'll get to this evening, because it's now almost 10. But to wrap up here, how do enlightenment assist others? Go back to the wide-angle lens. What impact on planet Earth did Buddha Shakyamuni have? And that's the answer to your question. Look what he did. Look at the impact on India and how that tsunami of his presence has flown out all over all of Asia for 2,500 years. And now in the 2,600 year, has gone global. The impact continues, reverberating all over the place. That's just his historical presence, let alone the countless yogis, the adepts, who've had, you know, Gnostic visions of the Buddha, of Vajradhara, of Vajrapani, Tara, Manjushri, etc., etc., etc. It just keeps, and all the dharmas, all the mind treasures that have been revealed over the last 1,000 years or so. That's the impact of a Buddha. Shifting over to another tradition. What's the impact of this extraordinary individual known as Jesus the Christ? You know, what's the impact? Well, people have screwed up his teachings, but then so have they screwed up democracy and capitalism and Buddhism and everything else. People do that. But if we look at his teachings, what he embodied, what he taught, then we see also, I mean, his blessing to the world is almost inconceivable, including in the Christian church, even though it screws up. Well, we all do. And so they're just two. And then we can go, well, how about Nagarjuna? And what about Lao Tzu? And what about 14th Dalai Lama? A man who's got no money to speak of, no wealth like, you know, wealthy people these days. He has no political power whatsoever. Regarded as, frankly, something of a joke when he first came out, God King, you know, the press were ready to rip him apart when he first came to the United States in 79. And then he arrived. I know this from Jeffrey Hopkins, who was his interpreter. The press were just ready to slice and dice when he came to America. The cynical, very atheistic, hardcore, materialistic American press, which is a pretty good generalization, frankly, they were really ready to slice and dice him when he came. You know, one more phony baloney Asian guru thinks he's a God King and all this stuff, you know. And he came and just melted them. Traveled all over the country, he just melted them. The swords fell from their hands. And that's just been going on ever since. That's the impact. Whether you regard him as a Buddha, at the very least, I think we have to give him Bodhisattva status. That's the impact. And then we can look at the many, many beings throughout history in multiple traditions. And we see the deeper they are, the more they've purified their minds, the more they've cultivated wisdom, cultivated compassion, embodied this in their lives and their activities, the greater the benefit, even from the humblest beginnings. You know, what was Gandhi? What was he, a lawyer in Africa? That's not exactly a power position to launch from, to try to revolutionize India. Desmond Tutu, you know, and so forth. These are really such beings, are really the hope for the world. And the more we can evolve, mature, grow along the spiritual path, then it's just empirically evident the greater benefit we can be. You know? So then we're now, it's wide-angle lens. That's actually what's happening. That's how Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, great saints and enlightened beings, that's how. They're offering something beyond hope for hedonic well-being. You know? So I'm back there. So we make this very personal. It's easy to get caught up in doctrine and metaphysics and esoteric mysticism. But then it's important just to come back, get the feet back on the ground again and say, okay, how am I doing right now? What can this person right here offer to the world? And I say, well, I'm hemmed in, like, you know, surrounded by barbed wire, by my own mental afflictions and obscurations. Some virtues, not entirely devoid of. But insofar as my afflictions should subside and the capacity, the potentials of my own Buddha nature should manifest, then it's just obvious. I'll be able to be a greater benefit. I think I'm of greater benefit now than I was 20 or 30 years ago. I think so, pretty sure. Nothing exalted, nothing fabulous, but better than what it was 30 years ago. And that's because I was practicing in the interval. The Dalai Lama said that, you know, whatever he's offered to the world, this comes from his practice, which really kicked in when he was about 15 or so. But he said, that's directly related. I've been practicing very regularly with great enthusiasm, devotion, dedication since then. And so if I can offer more to now, just very personally, I'm going to offer a little bit now, a bunch of books, you know, a lot of talking. But if it can be a benefit now, more so than 20 years ago, then if I can continue to purify, just follow the path as well as I can, then the chances are I'll probably be of greater benefit 20 years from now than I am now. And that's how. And then progressing along the path, eventually hopefully becoming a Vijjadhara, much more benefit, much, much more benefit. And then on to Buddha, much more benefit. So if we keep our feet on the ground, we say, but this is a self-answering question. The more hemmed in we are by our mental afflictions, habituations, and all of that, you know, can't do much. A little bit of sympathy for other suffering, but not much. You know, like seeing people drowning in the ocean and jumping in and drowning with them and saying, I really feel with you. I feel for you. You know, glub, 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 glub. So the more we can liberate ourselves, the more we can free ourselves, the more we can make manifest potentials of our own substrate consciousness, for starters, Buddha nature, ultimately. It's just an empirical fact. We can be of greater benefit. We shouldn't worry too much about the details, just because that's just so true, so obviously true. And it makes life simple, then, that we really have only two things to do, and that is unveil our own riches, purify our own minds. That's got to be ultimately of meaning, of value, without any discussion. And be of service. Do whatever we can to alleviate suffering, help the world, be of service to the world. Those are two, in my mind, non-negotiable. These are simply self-evidently meaningful. And then bodhicitta just says, okay, now put those two together. Recognize your current limitations, recognize the need of sentient beings, and now get your act together and achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings that will enable you to be of greatest possible benefit. So get cracking. That's it. Okay? Oh, yeah. Now I've gone over. See you at 4:30. Enjoy your day.